Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Fly! Fly, do you hear me? Give my creation! Fly!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Are there any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast.
My fellow Americans,
ask not what your country can do for you,
ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream. This is the Guy James Show. The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you've read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Yes, it is Guy James. I am here. At long last today, I am here. And glad to be here, by the way. Thank you for joining us today. So good to have all of you along with me. I'm having a problem here getting my audio straightened out in my ears. I think it's okay in your ears, probably just in mine, where I'm having a bit of a problem today. Anyway, we're glad to be here. We're coming to you from the Blue Waters and Sandy Beaches of beautiful Southwest Florida. We have an interesting show for you today. I say interesting because I have somebody on the show that I mentioned yesterday, somebody I was going to have on the show that I never thought I'd ever have on the Guy James Show. I'm sure Bob Barr, former Congressman Bob Barr, is going to be on the show today. And we've never spoken, and I think we'll probably agree to put our political differences aside today, and they are about as polar opposite as you could be. But we'll put our political differences aside today and talk about an issue that we both agree upon. So we'll have him coming up pretty doggone soon, right around 20 minutes after the hour, I think. And then we're going to do something very, very different in the second hour today, very different. And I don't know that anyway, I want to hammer home a point I've been making for a long time now about the propagandists from the right wing, the Limbaughs and the Hannitys and the Mark Levins and the Savages and the Gallaghers and the list goes on and on and on. It'd take me all day to recite them all for you. But I want to hammer home the correlation between them and what has gone on in the Republican Party for many, many years, going back to the McCarthy era, and we'll do that with their own words in the second hour of the program today. So we'll have Joseph McCarthy, we'll have Edward R. Murrow, and we'll decide whether or not it's germane to the discussion today about the propagandists from the right wing. A whole lot going on right now. I see the House did push through the version of the Senate bill about the credit cards, so that's going to go in effect very soon, and I think it'll go into effect maybe in 9 months rather than 12 as the original House bill had it. It's going to be that they can't change the credit card companies can't change your rates without giving you a 45-day notice. They can't, the whole list of things that they can and can't do in there. What did I do with it? I had a list here someplace. Anyway, it's going to force the financial industry to change things around and quit some of the predatory practices that they've done for a long time. The money that they made from customers who didn't pay their bills in full every month became really their most important revenue source, as it wasn't the way it started out. And it was something that was consumer friendly when it first started out, and it became real albatross here in the last few years. Lots of people in deep credit card debt, and so some of the things are going to be changed in the consumer's favor, and I'm glad to see that. I'm glad to see that somebody stuck up for us for a change. I did want to mention before I went too much farther that it is time that some of our Congress critters stood up for us, because last week, was it last week, when they proposed, Bernie Sanders proposed a bill to limit interest rates to 15%. 15%. And it didn't pass. And it didn't pass because the Democrats helped the Republicans. Of course, only one Republican voted to limit the interest rate, and that was Charles Grassley of Iowa, oddly enough, old curmudgeon. And other than that, it was all Republicans. Every Republican except Grassley voted no to limit the interest rates to 15%. And some very notable Democrats, and some of the Democrats you might have expected, joined them. Carper from Delaware, Maria Cantwell from Washington, the usual suspects, Robert Byrd from West Virginia, Jeff Bingham from New Mexico, Evan Bayh, of course, from Indiana, Max Baucus, of course, who is owned by the credit card industry of Montana. These are Democrats that voted not to limit the interest rates last week. Daniel Akaka from Hawaii. Warner from Virginia, Chester from Montana, Debbie Stabenow from Michigan. A little bit of a surprise there. No surprise, Arlen Specter, that now has the D behind his name, which shames me. Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire, Mark Pryor, Ben Nelson, Bill Nelson, Patty Murray, all helping the Republicans keep from getting interest rates limited to 15%. Of course, Blanche Lincoln and Joe Lieberman and Mary Landrieu, Ted Kaufman, Tim Johnson, Kay Hagan of North Carolina. So a whole bunch of Democrats last week. And we know all we have to do is take a look at the contributions to their campaign, to each of their campaigns, and we know how they're going to vote on that issue. And it's a damn shame. And I mean, there it is. It's pretty transparent. You can look and see just what kind of money that the financial institutions have put into the campaigns of those Democrats that voted to not limit the credit card industry's interest rates last week. But at least they got a bill that is more friendly through the House today, through the House and the Senate. So it will go to the president's desk before very long and get it signed. So there's a little bit of help on the way, a little bit of help. For your information, in case you didn't already know it, the Employee Free Choice Act is dead, D-O-A, not going to happen, just not going to happen. And, of course, the Democrats folded once again. I don't know. You get a Republican president in power and a Republican Congress, and they're going to go along with, in lockstep with everything he wants to do. Lockstep, almost 100%. Here we go. We want to close Guantanamo, and Harry Reid leads the charge not to. Oh, we can't have these people in the United States. We can't have these terrorists. Oh, they're very, very scary, and we can't have them in the United States. First, we have to release them, and then we have to incarcerate them. I don't know what the hell Harry Reid's even talking about. I don't think he does either. As you well know, I don't have any respect left for Harry Reid. But here he is leading the charge to deny funds to close Guantanamo until they get a better plan. Where was it? Somebody in a city in Montana offered to take them? I mean, there's only, what, a couple hundred of them or so? We've got these, I mean, airtight prisons in this country, supermax prisons, and they're telling us that they can't hold some of these backwoods terrorists. I mean, I'm saying some of them aren't bad guys. Of course they're bad guys. But are they saying the prisons in this country can't hold them? Come on. Come on. Ooh, we can't have them in our backyard. Oh, no, no, we don't want to have them in our backyard. So we can't close Gitmo. And Harry Reid leading the charge on that. Damn Harry Reid. And good news. Good news. Senator Edward Kennedy's brain cancer is in remission. This thrills me. And he's expected back in the Senate after the Memorial Day recess. And he'll be working hard on the health care reform. You know he will. So that's a great thing. That's a great thing. I'm so happy about that, and let's hope his cancer stays in remission, and he'll be in here. He'll be in the Senate slugging it out over health care before very long. Harry Reid has confirmed that Kennedy will return in June, and even though he hasn't been in the Senate for a while now, I mean, hasn't been present, he's been working behind the scenes. And he's gone here and there to help the party out and working on the Medicare legislation that's coming up in July. And he made that visit to the Democratic National Convention in the fall. And so this was a good thing, good news, and I'm very, very pleased. John Kerry is one of his best friends in all the world, is very pleased as well. Michael Steele hasn't done anything to endear himself to Republicans, now has he? I didn't think it would ever be possible, but Michael Steele probably has passed Sarah Palin as the biggest Republican laughingstock horse's ass on the planet. And it was reported in today's Washington Post that every time the guy opens his mouth, he says something stupid. He's a cluster, you know what. He's an embarrassment to the Republican Party in a lot of ways, and they'd like to get rid of him, and I think they probably will. They'll force him out. They won't actually throw him out. They'll force him out. How would that look if the Republicans actually asking a black man to resign as their party chairman? How would that look? And they're mindful of that, you bet. My question is, how on God's green earth did Republican leaders elect this guy as their party chairman in the first place? I mean, they must have been drunk. Maybe they were stoned, I don't know. But whatever the cause, Steele's days have got to be numbered as their chairman, and it would be an act of sympathy to really put him out of his misery right now. Hey, and somebody, it was Sophie, as a matter of fact, who gave me a suggestion a while back. We're always looking for ways to save money. Sophie gave me a suggestion on how to throw in a good recipe here now and then. Get your pencils out. Recipes for hard times. This is one of our hard times recipes. I made this the other night. I think Monday night? Yeah, I made this Monday night, and it was terrific. It just turned out terrific. It's oh so good, and went out to rave reviews. If you got your pencil and paper out, and I don't know, maybe I'll have a chance to print it a little later or something. But cheap food, and delicious food, and this is a recipe that'll go a long, long way, and. I know somebody tuned in right now saying, is Guy James really giving out recipes on the show? Yeah, yes, in fact, we're going to do one. We're going to call them our hard times recipes. You get a pound and a half of ground beef, one packet of taco seasoning, one can, a regular 15-ounce can, 15 and a half, whatever it is, of dark red beans, 15 or 14 and a half count ounce can of diced tomatoes. And you make 6 cups of cooked white rice. That's 3 cups dry. So 6 cups of rice, that's a lot of rice. A cup of salsa, a cup of chopped onion, and a cup of shredded sharp cheddar cheese. And it's really simple to make. It takes a little bit of prep time. You preheat your oven to 400 degrees and oil up or spray up a big old 9x13 baking dish or casserole dish. And in a large skillet or saucepan, you brown the ground beef. You know how to brown beef. I don't have to tell you that. You just brown until it's brown and crumbly, and you add the taco seasoning and the beans and the tomatoes and the onions and the saucepan, and, boy, that's a good mixture right there. And you simmer it for about 10 minutes. Let the flavors all get all mixed up in there really good. And then you get yourself a big bowl, because it's going to be a big bowl now. And you combine the meat and the bean mixture with the rice and the salsa and stir it all up real well and, you know, put it in your baking dish, and you bake it for 20 to 25 minutes. you know, until it's heated through. But 20, 25 minutes will do it. And you remove it from the oven and put the cheese over the top, and then you put it back in the oven for 3 to 5 minutes. Oh, mama, is this good. I'm telling you, you're going to like this. So it's a Guy James recipe for hard times, and some of us are having hard times. It's a cheap dish, goes a long way. See, I got Texas Betsy complaining about putting beef in it already. Ground soy, I couldn't do that. I want to give a shout out quickly to Andrew. Andrew sent me a really nice email along with a contribution for the show. And he said, keep up the great show and don't get downcast. Optimism is a great motivation for contributions. Of course, keeping a realistic view of outcomes. I feel the radio station has a great future. Just always clarify to listeners that, you know, they've got to fund every organization to make it a better place. It's all in their hands. And contributions on their part are an investment in a brighter day and a more principled way forward. Keep up the vital work, pal. Andrew, thank you very much. You get a note like this once in a while, and it will kind of buoy your spirits a little bit if you are a certain talk show host. All right. We got Bob Barr coming up in just a moment or two. Yes, for those of you just joining it, I did say Bob Barr is going to be on the show again. Yes. How about the banks? How about the banks? We found out that they're using tax-free benefits from life insurance. Now get this. They're taking out life insurance on their employees, making themselves, the banking company, the beneficiary. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they keep that money to pay executive bonuses, deferred pay, and pensions. That's right. If you work for a bank, you might just have a life insurance policy on your ass, and the beneficiary is the bank. And when you die, your family's not getting the money. Oh, no, no, no. The bank's getting the money, and they got to pass it out to the fat cats that get the bonuses. I just thought you'd like to know that. This issue of executive pay and in particular bonuses has been under public scrutiny in the recent months, and so now we find out how they're going to fund some of their stuff. Mm-hmm. Life insurance on their employees. So when you die, and you will sometime, then then the bank's going to get the money. Oh, yes. We're a couple of minutes away from having Bob Barr join us on the program here. And I think, let's see, what do we do for 2 minutes here? Let's just do this. We'll be right back. back. You are listening to the Guy James Show here on the Hit On Radio Network. We're expecting Bob Barr to be calling in here any minute now, so we'll wait around for that. Let's just all sit and wait, okay? Supposed to call at 3:20. It's now 3:20 and 40 seconds. Well, you've got a little bit of delay if you're hearing this on the. But anyway, that's what I always worry about. I'd rather call guests than have them call me, but sometimes they insist on calling me, so that's the way it's going to be. That recipe, in case you didn't get it, somebody said they didn't have time to write it down. 1.5 pounds of ground beef, or ground soy, somebody said. A pack of taco seasoning, 1 can of dark red beans, 1 can of diced tomatoes. These are the 15-ounce cans. 6 cups of cooked white rice. That's 3 cups dry. 1 cup of salsa, 1 cup of chopped onions, 1 cup of shredded sharp cheddar cheese. You brown all that stuff in the skillet, you know, cook the rice separate, and then you mix it all together, and you bake it in a big old 9x13 casserole dish for 20, 25 minutes in a 400-degree oven. Pull it out and throw the cheese on top of it, 1 cup of cheddar cheese. Sprinkle that all around, and then bake it for another 3 to 5 minutes. That cheese melted on the top. And it's cheap. It is cheap. That's the good thing. Cheap, I tell you. All right, well, we're a couple minutes behind time here on our guest waiting, and I hate to, it's one of those things that, oh, Texas Betsy said they use something similar. They use noodles instead of rice. That sounds good as well. We'll have to try that. Yes, I will have to try that. I like that. You know, we talk a lot of the time about companies bailing out here in this country. And there are some good old-fashioned companies that still produce things in this country that haven't completely bailed out of the U.S. yet. And some of them's got some warts, the things that we don't like, I know. But GE, for example, you got Harley-Davidson, you got Brunswick. And they're not making bowling balls so much anymore or pin setter machines. They're making boats and doing okay. The Fender Guitar Company, Pfizer, Dow Chemical, yeah, I know, U.S. Steel, Boeing is our largest exporter money-wise. You got Caterpillar, and you got Hershey, good old Hershey. So, you know, there's still some companies that are all-American companies that keeping a lot of jobs here in this country. And I know that there are a lot of products that many manufacturers are thinking about getting rid of right now. And I read a list of them today, and I was a little bit surprised. But people are trying to pare down the list of products that they produce and keep only the most profitable ones. And Gleam toothpaste, I think that's been around all my life, if I'm not mistaken, or maybe came out when I was just a kid. They're thinking about getting rid of Gleam toothpaste. Of course, you know that Hummer, Saturn, and Pontiac are going bye-bye. They may keep going, but General Motors is trying to sell them off. They're not trying to sell Pontiac. I think they're just going to close it down. Pioneer TVs. They're going to stop making Pioneer TVs. And, of course, newspapers all over the country, and big ones, for example, Minneapolis and Chicago newspapers. And the Vizio plasma TVs. They are they're going to stop making their plasma TVs. The Handy Snacks pudding, Kool-Aid gels, and Saab. I don't know how many people miss their Saabs. Not a lot of those running around. I'll tell you one thing. I saw something that scared me today. A notice in the news that make me think twice before I get on another Puddle Jumper airline plane, you know, when you sometimes have to make a connecting flight someplace, like sometimes here to go to Washington, you got to go to Miami first. If you can't get a direct flight at the time you want, you have to fly to Miami and then go from there to D.C. Sometimes. You know what I'm talking about. Little prop jet planes and all that. That one had crashed here a few weeks ago. They found it was pilot error. And these Puddle Jumper Airlines have found that the one that's crashed especially was found to pay the pilot around $23,000 a year. I'm not sure I want to fly on a plane where the pilot made it some kind of a career choice between flying and between Walmart and flying. I don't know about that. I didn't know that any airline paid that kind of money. Man, you'd have to fly, love to fly a lot to work for that kind of money out flying every day. Oh, we're still waiting for our guest to call, and it's not looking good. They're 6 minutes late right now. And do we have a good Bob Barr impersonator out there someplace? Any of you? I could do it. Let me see. Where are we at here? I don't know. I did read a funny story, too, about do you read about this one? And, of course, it took place in Florida. All the weird crap takes place in Florida. This woman left a 7-Eleven, and she had a bulge in her slacks. Brittany Garapi, this Florida woman, she was departing a 7-Eleven last night when a store clerk noticed a suspicious bulge in the front of her pants, this 20-year-old woman. And so they decided that maybe with the suspicious bulbs in the front of her pants, she might have been shoplifting. So the convenience store employees contacted a cop who approached her in the parking lot. And though she initially denied swiping anything, Garapi was confronted with evidence spotted inside her car. And it was an empty wrapper for a $1.19 Big Mama pickled sausage. That's according to Hernando County Sheriff's report. Yes, the item in question was a $1.19 Big Mama pickled sausage. And the lump that was clearly visible inside her pants, it was a 2.4-ounce pork product that she apparently consumed after she stole it. And she was already on probation, but she was charged with shoplifting and also possession of drug paraphernalia after they searched her van and found a pipe with methamphetamine residue. You ought to read the police report on this. The item in question was a 2.4-ounce Big Mama pickled sausage. The wrapper in question was found inside of, police speak, how that goes. It's funny stuff. Well, it's not looking good for our guest right now. We'll wait and see if, that does a number on you when you've got things kind of scheduled out. Think the way you think show's going to go. Oh, yes, we promised today that we were going to talk about what happened in this country. Just what happened? Why are we where we're at with this economy? Just crashing the way it has and staying that way. And I don't know about you, but I don't see any signs of it coming back anytime soon. I don't see any signs that it is on its way up or that it's flattened out. I'm seeing people getting laid off every day. I'm seeing more people lose their homes. I'm seeing more people run out of benefits, unemployment benefits. I'm seeing the food pantries here where I live anyway are dried up, don't have enough contributions to keep going. And What was really happening when this all got started was that the financial companies were extracting equity that had been built up over nearly a century by businesses and consumers, and the financial industry had become a predatory business. I think we all know that, and they've been scavenging the land and pillaging for any pocket of wealth they could possibly get to convert into cash that would be funneled in part to the banks as fees. And we're all getting weary of bank fees. And there was no oversight. And there needed to be oversight. And this was a job for government policy and business professors. And most of them were spent their time enabling and cheerleading for the banks. And moreover, some of what the industry did helped their customers. Some of it was helpful. This automatic bill paying, that's a great thing. Even though they didn't make as much money off of that, the bank still threw us a bone there with the with the automated bill paying. I like that system. But since the large banks and the financial companies in the U.S. have just blown up, and the financial institutions on Wall Street, in part because the equity available for mining, and that's what they've been doing, they've been mining equity from all of us, from wherever they could get it. And that's what I call it, mining for equity, and the extraction of it, that it's dried up. And now that the equity that they've taken over all these years, that they've gotten a hold of, it's dried up, and who's getting asked to save their asses? Of course, you know, it's you and me. And as taxpayers, we do represent the very last available and large pool of equity that they're after, and the good faith and credit of the United States as represented by the government's taxing power. And at this very moment, the financial oligarchs, they're at it again. They're looking for ways to convert stored up wealth into cash for themselves. And don't you think you should know who they are and what game is going on here? I think we all should know. We all don't necessarily know. You take mutual funds, for example. That's the traditional form of the way they mined equity. Mutual fund industry made tens of billions of dollars. And what they do there, they pay themselves by extracting as much as 0.75% from your investment portfolio every year as their fee. Doesn't matter if you make money or not, they're taking that 0.75%. And if you sit down and figure it out, you take a pen and pencil to it, if you put $100,000 into a mutual fund, after 20 years, the fund managers will have taken $15,000 of your equity in fees. Doesn't matter if you made any money or not. And to justify that, the first thing mutual fund managers do is set the bar for their performance as low as they possibly can. They don't ask you to judge their performance on how much investment gains they made for you each year. They don't ask you that at all. They judge themselves on how well they performed in relation to the market's performance. And here's the way it works. If the market declines 5% during the year, but they've put you in an investment that only lost 4%, then they say, oh man, we're really great. And even if they do more poorly than the market, they still take their 0.75% out of your account. And so if things are going along really well and the market's going up, as it did for a good many years, you don't notice that 0.75% so much. And it's really important for the mutual fund industry to have the market going up. But should the market hit a rough patch, and it sure as hell has, the industry's all ready for you in case that happens too. And you know as well as I do, if you've studied the financial market at all, that there isn't a mutual fund manager in the world who isn't armed with one of those handy-dandy little charts showing you in the long-term performance of the market appreciating at a 8% rate per annum over time. They all have those charts, 8%. It's just automatic. They've all got one behind the desk, and that's what they pull out and show you. And based on an 8% gain of year after year after year, and they've got a 100-year chart showing you that you make $7 zillion if you put the money in, and it piles up at 8% every year, 8% every year. And the industry trains its salesmen to believe that 8% per annum returns are in the long run going to happen just, ordained by God some way. And they make you believe it's pretty much just guaranteed. We're in for the long run. And the mutual fund industry emphasizes that the investor needs to invest for the long haul. They don't want your money moving in and out of the account. They want it sitting right there with them year after year, earning 0.75% guaranteed. That's the difference between you and the mutual fund industry. That 8% per annum they imply is a guaranteed return on your money really isn't. But do know that the 0.75% fee guaranteed to the fund is guaranteed for them. Always. And then you've got your hedge funds people. And actually, the hedge fund people, I don't know how much you've studied hedge funds, but they're really the mutual fund industry on steroids. Hedge funds get a whole lot more money for an annual fee, usually 2% per annum, and they typically restrict participation only to people with, you know, who are wealthy, got maybe $500,000 to invest or more. So the fee's a whole lot more lucrative. It's not some Joe Smith, you and me, putting $1,000 into a market or $5,000. Three-quarters of a percent of that is enough, but you get somebody putting $500,000 a crack in there, or $1 million, 2% of that's a pretty doggone good return. And so they do typically restrict hedge funds participation just to people who are wealthy. And so to attract these people, the hedge fund promises outsized market performances. They promise the big money. And they've, to their credit, have made big money until recently. And so in this sense, they're really, really different from mutual funds in that they ask their investors to judge them on the positive returns they make year after year, even in down markets. Because they do, and put it in quotation marks, guarantee positive returns. And they also take 20% off the investment profit each year, leaving 80% for the investor. So they're taking 2% of your money, whether you make any money or not. They make you think it's pretty much guaranteed because they've got such a great reputation for making big money if you put big money in it. And then they're going to take 20% of your profit. And there now you can see how some of these hedge fund managers have made tens, actually hundreds of million dollars a year personally. And the markets that the hedge fund industry invest in are the exact same markets that the mutual fund industry invest in. So how do the hedge funds guarantee a profit? For one, they don't always buy stocks. They sometimes go short on the market, and selling the stocks in advance of a down move and making a profit on as the stock goes down. Mutual funds don't do that. And secondly, and much more important, hedge funds employ leverage. They take your $100,000, and this is where I have a problem with hedge funds. They take your $100,000, and they borrow $3 million. That's right. They can leverage the money 30 to 1. And then they invest all of it. I mean, this is risky stuff. Let's say you've only got $100,000 in the real equity in it. You can be wiped out in just a 3% down move in the market. That's how the hedge funds actually work. And so it becomes essential for the hedge funds to ensure they make a profit. And part of this is done in an honest-to-God way by time in the market. Some of the hedge funds own stocks when the market's going up, and they go short when the market's going down. And this is really hard to do. So only a small minority of hedge funds are actually good at trading with their wits. And the rest of it needs some help. And I don't know if you've figured out how they get their help. But a lot of these hedge funds are bullies. They have such huge amounts to invest that the mere act of investing distorts market liquidity. And they are able, with a large amount of money that they have to invest, they're able to force prices to go into the direction that they want. You can ask George Soros about that. They invest so much money that they can drive the market in whatever direction they want it to go. A lot of the hedge funds are momentum investors. They jump on the bandwagon and ride the market for all it's worth. And they're distorting the market in the process. That's how the oil was pushed up to, what was it, $143, $147 a barrel. And last year, and just as quickly as that, went back down again. The hedge funds were in there pushing it up and scrambling to get out of it at the same time. So they made money on the way up, and they made money on the way down. And then there's the hedge funds, which are highly questionable. And I think the hedging that they've done riding the market up and down is questionable to me. But they're flirting with illegalities by seeking insider information. They've got their ear to the ground and they're finding out about potential mergers or acquisitions, and that's the easiest and cleanest way to do that is to you know, align your hedge funds with the mergers and acquisitions department of a big bank. And that way you can lose your leverage to bet on the company being acquired. And more often than not, create the pressure necessary to force the acquired company to sell to their predator. There's some really mean-ass bullying tactics that are taking place by hedge funds. And then you've got the private equity. And you all recognize the game, the name of the guy that was instrumental in getting that going in a big way was Michael Milken in the 1980s as the leveraged buyout business. And really, private equity is the practice of borrowing huge amounts of money to take over a company and then liquidate its common equity so that it's entirely privately owned by the investors and then slim it down and shape it up so that the company can be brought back, bring it back to the stock market in a public stock offering and make a huge profit for the private owners. But what's really crazy about that and how they've ever allowed this to happen is beyond my comprehension. You think that the big banks and the investment firms don't have hold sway with, I mean, I tell you, they get away with murder. Suppose you don't have the money to buy something as big as a company. And this is what they do. You're these private equity firms, and you don't have the money to buy a company. Let's XYZ company. Easy. You just go borrow it from the bank, and what you use as the collateral are the very assets of the company that you're trying to buy. You don't have any money. You're going to buy XYZ company, and you go to bank, and well, you don't have any money, but I'm going to use the assets of the company, XYZ company, to get this loan. And, you know, the very audacity of taking over a company you don't own by borrowing against this assets is one of the great travesties of modern finance, but the government has never seen fit to outlaw that practice, and why, I'll never know. And in case you're wondering why, the management of a company puts up with the predatory tactics of the private equity industry, in many such buyouts, the management of the company is operating secretly in cahoots with the private equity buyer. So the manager's sitting there saying to the stockholder, gee, they're trying to buy us out. And so the manager gets a side agreement to continue to run the company after it's taken over and to get millions of dollars in guaranteed payouts for agreeing to do it. And the people that really lose in this game, you guessed it, are the employees. Usually when this is done, at least 15% or more of the staff can be fired to help trim down the company so that they can resell it and make it look profitable. And another thing that's always quick to go when they do these leverage buyouts is the employee pension plan. They raid the employee pension plan and leave it empty. It's looted by the private equity investors. And one of the earliest practitioners of private equity was Jack Welch, who was known as Neutron Jack for his practice of buying companies and leaving only the building standing. That's how they do it. And then you've got your home equity lines of credit. And this is something that most people do understand because it's happening all around them. If this private equity mining sounds familiar, it should. It's the exact same process went on in the home mortgage business. These buccaneers of finance found equity to extract, not just in corporate America, but they went out to where the real money was, the masses. They went out among the consumers and found the wealth that they'd had built up in their homes, millions of people. Some people spent decades paying off their mortgages. And in the 1990s, the banks created the tool to mine this equity, the home equity line of credit. And that's something that's turned into a really dirty word, which effectively turned homes into commodities and cash machines. And so when the Federal Reserve lowered the interest rates on these lines of credit to 1% back in 2001, I think it was 2001. Now the doors are wide open for the great looting of the American dream. And that's exactly what happened. Consumers were already in the mood to borrow against their home because their wages have been stagnant for 20 years. They hadn't gained anything financially in 20 years. So all of a sudden they've got their home here, and they may have a $100,000 home, and they only owe 40 grand on it. And this home equity line looked mighty, mighty enticing to a lot of people. And so the banks knew that. And they knew people were anxious to get their hands on some dollars to do some home repairs or whatever, buy a new car, take a vacation. And they put up this great marketing campaign, and they began to convince consumers to lower their monthly payments. And in the campaign, you never heard them mention the word debt. They never said that. They were given the impression they somehow had cash locked up in their house that they could now just go draw it out like an ATM machine. And the people that got these home equity, they were rarely told the truth about any of this. That's how the banking industry works. And this was equity being exchanged for debt. And the banking and the mortgage industry, in the meantime, extracted trillions of dollars in points and fees, points and fees, points and fees. The amounts are so staggering that you can see in the national housing statistics how home equity has collapsed while mortgage debt has gone sky high. And how did this all happen? Why did a lot of this happen? A lot of this happened because of these cheerleaders on TV. Oh, yes. I call them the cheerleading squad. You can go about raping and looting the wealth of this country without important help in keeping the public oblivious. You got to help, have some help keeping the public, with their heads in the sand or whatever, ignorant. And that's the role of the propaganda arms of the financial industry. The Wall Street Journal, the business pages of the newspapers, CNBC. Did you ever hear the people on CNBC during this whole time talking down business, talking down the financial industry? Hell no. You got your think tanks, Wall Street in general. Public was told over and over and over again that this equity mining in a social was a social good that cleaned out the deadwood in corporations and rewarded all the visionaries amongst us. And in the long run, they say it provided jobs. And it helps if the government alters the official unemployment statistics to ignore the people who are underemployed. But anyway, the financial buccaneers themselves are to be glorified publicly with plenty of airtime on CNBC and you know, Fox Financial Network. And the people who were the naysayers and saw the bubbles being blown up and knew that they're kept off of it. They're kept out of the public eye. And nowhere was this more prevalent than on CNBC. And it's owned and managed by General Electric Corporation. You know that. It used to be a big manufacturing company and still does a lot of manufacturing, but they've gotten the bulk of its profits from its finance arm. And to top it off, GE was run by the most worshipful business manager of all time, Jack Welch. That's the same Neutron Jack who made a specialty of firing people and who'd made a career grabbing equity from companies that GE would buy and then sell. And he was on a throne at GE. He was lauded as the most talented business manager in America. And he's still invited to companies and seminars to pass out his wisdom for a substantial fee. And he's got the greatest golden parachute that you ever heard of from GE. But ever so often he gets questions from these days about why GE's profit collapsed shortly after he left the company. And the real answer is that the equity mining business at GE Capital Markets had run its course. But the public answers ignored this. Instead, we're led to believe that the people who are left running GE after Jack Welch didn't have the talent that he had. But they own CNBC, and they're able to control the amount of criticism directed at them by the business media. Now, I will give credit where credit is due, and guys like John Stewart, of all people, has exposed these CNBC people when he went after, Jim, that idiot, and just humiliated him on his show. But CNBC's still at it. You can watch that, and I often do, just to see this exact experience taking place. They acknowledge that things happened that they didn't think was going to happen. But they're still at it. And the other thing is, these people, you don't need to be a banker to run a major bank these days. And in fact, very few CEOs of big banks are bankers. This Vikram Pandit, that's the head of Citigroup right now, he ran a hedge fund. And now he's running a bank. He took over for Chuck Prince over at Citigroup, who was a former general counsel. The incestuous relationship between Wall Street and these guys, it's amazing. And a lot of these guys never made a bank loan in their lives. Guys ahead of these huge financial institutions. And what they know about credit or other banking risk is what people reporting to them has told them. That's all they know. And why don't you need personal experience as a banker to run a bank? Because the only thing these guys need, the only thing that they all have in common, that they're all serial acquirers of other banks. And in this respect, they're kind of like Jack Welch or private equity investors. And the skill they're purveying is their ability to buy other banks and fire people and dress themselves up as visionaries and heroes and willing to make tough decisions, and they go on CNBC and become heroes. And they've all got these narcissistic personalities because they think themselves and want to be seen as indispensable to the bank's future. It's a CEO worship, really. And they're expected to, and they do, dominate their board of directors and get anything they want from their board of directors. And they're the public face of the bank, and they always end up with outlandish personal rewards in the process. And it's to these guys that we owe that ridiculous reality of too big to fail. Too big to fail. In their rush to buy other banks and in their desire to be the biggest on the block, they've created behemoths that touch almost all areas of the economy. And at some point in the last decade, but certainly after 1999, when it was now legal to combine an investment with a commercial bank, all the big players did just that. And this alone produced financial companies so large that their failure would, in fact, impact millions of Americans, but the real cost of failure showed up in something called systemic risk. And this is the risk that the failure of one bank will drag down one or more other banks to default as well, creating kind of a daisy chain of financial destruction, if you will. And in the early 1990s, there were probably 75 major banks in the world that dealt regularly with each other, so the daisy chain wasn't quite so small. But by 2000, thanks to the efforts of these serial acquirers like Jack Welch and his friends running the banking industry, this number of major banks was reduced to 20. And at that point, it was too late. The collapse of a bank in Spain, when there's only 20 major banks in the world, you have a bank in Spain or Malaysia or someplace else that collapses, it could drag down a bank in the U.S. or Australia or somewhere else. And, of course, compounding the systemic risk is the fact that in all major industrial countries, except maybe Japan, housing bubbles have erupted in response to the commoditization of the housing stock at very low interest rates. So these guys have perfected this. They've got this down to a science. And you get the government involved at this point, and what could they do? They were absolutely helpless. They were inept. You you had the Office of, what were they called, Thrift Supervision, the Office of Federal Housing, Enterprise Oversight. They were supposed to be regulating Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they were supposed to be regulating some of these big companies, and the SEC was supposed to be doing their jobs, and at the same time, their budgets were being cut so they didn't have enough people to do the job of oversight that they were supposed to do. And it all worked out just so well, didn't it? They ran wild. They ran absolutely wild. Unfettered. They did anything they wanted for a decade. And nobody was the wiser. Oh, we had a few people here and there screaming about it. You had the Bernie Madoffs. And they literally robbed and pillaged all the equity that they could get their hands on from the people of the United States and from the companies and put it in the pockets of the millionaires and billionaires being the gated communities. I could go on and on and on and talk about this, and maybe in the next day or two we will get to talking about the relationship of Goldman Sachs and all this. That is a fascinating story, Goldman Sachs. Make no mistake that Goldman Sachs is responsible for nearly all of the ideas coming up in the domestic financial arena today. Their people have infiltrated the government, the Treasury Department, the SEC, everywhere. Goldman Sachs is everywhere. They're all over the Obama administration. They were all over the Bush administration, Henry Paulson, Geithner. A list a mile long. Governor of New Jersey. Goldman Sachs has set the economic policy for the United States government. They have been doing it. They're still doing it. The government is polluted with ex-Goldman Sachs people. We'll talk a lot more about this in the days to come. It's a very interesting saga. I was looking at my list of Goldman Sachs people, Robert Rubin, Hank Paulson, Geithner, who else? John Corzine, governor of New Jersey. The list is long. And they've just managed to get themselves promoted right up into the government and make one policy after another that benefits their buddies back in the Goldman Sachs offices. That's what happened. And there was no one there to stop it. And the media didn't do anything to stop it. Of course, there is no left-wing media. The right-wing media didn't do anything to stop it. And we're going to talk the second hour about how there is no left-wing media, or else how the right-wing media is running wild. And we'll make our comparisons that we promised about Rush Limbaugh and Joe McCarthy. We'll do that in the second hour of the program. So right now we're going to pause for news. Coming up at the top of the hour, you're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network. We'll be back right after the news, and we hope you'll join us. We got some interesting stuff coming up.
Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. The Oregon AFL-CIO, AFSCME, and the Oregon NEA are running radio ads in Oregon opposing Democratic Senator Ron Wyden's proposal to tax health care benefits like income. The labor organizations say that middle-class working families would take a $2,000 to $4,000 tax hit if health care benefits are taxed. During a press conference call on the issue, we asked why the debate isn't focused on a single-payer universal coverage system rather than wrangling over issues like whether or not to tax employer-based benefits. Some polls indicate a majority of Americans support single-payer. It saves 30% in overhead costs and covers everyone whether they have a job or not. Hundreds of labor organizations nationwide have signed on to support the Conyers single-payer health care bill, and millions of Americans do support single-payer. So why isn't it a part of the health care reform debate? Here's Oregon AFL-CIO President Tom Chamberlain's reply.
I don't know if we ever get to single payer in this country. I mean, what you're talking about is tearing completely down the existing system and starting from scratch. I just don't see how that's going to happen. I mean, the debate over the public option, which is just an option for employees, is intense. So going to a single player, I just don't think it's not part of the debate, and I don't know how it could be.
New York City's largest public employees union has launched a campaign over what it calls $9 billion in wasted money spent by the city to hire private contractors. Jesse Russell reports.
District Council 37 has begun posting ads in subways urging New Yorkers to tell Mayor Michael Bloomberg to cut private contractors, not public services. The council says that many of the contractors don't pay a living wage or provide health care benefits, and some don't even pay state or city taxes. During a May 7th city council hearing, it was suggested that Bloomberg has contracted out so much work because those contractors have the skills the city workers don't. DC 37 Executive Director Lillian Roberts disagreed with that suggestion and referred to $79 million in custodial work that is contracted out.
And you have welfare recipients who are funded by the state and the city. After their 5 years, they're working and they're looking for a job. And the job that they can do, I mean, they're doing it for 6 months for the city. And you take that money and give it to a private contractor and you don't employ them? How much skill do you need?
Here's today's economic report. We stacked up to 22 other countries ranked highly by economic and human development. The United States is the only country that does not guarantee workers receive paid sick days. According to a report by the Center for Economic Policy Research, the U.S. is the only country out of the 22 that doesn't provide sick leave for workers undergoing 50-day cancer treatments. When put in terms of the potential for a flu pandemic, the economic repercussions could be enormous.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Life, you hear me? Give my creation life.
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Good countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast.
What your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show. The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hey, welcome back to the show. You are listening, in fact, to the Guy James Show, proud member of the Head On Radio Network. And I do want to let you know we're going to do things a little different this hour of the program. We're going to do something we haven't done in a long time, maybe ever. We talk a good deal about the problems we have with the right-wing talkers, okay, about how they're the greatest propagandists who ever lived. And I do believe Rush Limbaugh, without question, is in a class by himself as the greatest propagandist who ever lived on this planet. Of course, he got a lot of buddies, his sanity pal and his, well, his former friend, Mike Savage. So I'll explain that in a moment. And, you know, the O'Reillys, all of them in it for the money, but they're great propagandists, and they've certainly done their job, and they've done it well. We may hate them, and I do, and I don't use that word loosely, I do hate them, but God, they've done their job well, and they've been provided with a platform to do it well. I don't know how good some of them are, but they've had a platform to sell their product from, and it's worked extremely well. I see Mike Savage and Limbaugh, I mean, well, it's one-sided. Savage says, here in America, I've had some people come to my aid. You know this problem about him not being able to go to England? They'll arrest him if they do. And they see the bigger picture. They're not like O'Reilly. They're not like Mr. Limbaugh. They're not like Limbaugh, who's the biggest disappointment of all. Limbaugh has turned out to be the biggest phony of all of them. All of them. Amongst all of them. He's the biggest fraud. Rush Limbaugh is a fraud. When he was accused of the drug usage, I supported him. But that man is a one-way street. It's all about him. He's in it for nobody but himself. Well, duh. Michael Savage, Michael Wiener. You didn't have that figured out before? No? Anyway, I dug out some great audio that I thought you'd enjoy hearing. It's history in the making. First of all, Senator Huey Long, a speech that he gave to the United States Senate called Sharing the Wealth. And I think it's something you all should hear. I don't agree with everything Huey says in it, but it's something that we're all accused of every day. So I thought it'd be interesting for you to hear and have a little history lesson along with me on some of this stuff. An address to the United States Senate by Huey Long from Louisiana, the revered Huey Long from Louisiana.
Our United States government, under the auspices of Woodrow Wilson, then the president, undertook to find out what was the trouble in America with the people generally. They appointed an industrial relations commission headed by Frank P. Walz of Kansas City, Missouri. They made an intensive study, and at the conclusion of that study, they reported that the chief cause and the chief trouble with America was that a small percent of the people owned a large percent of the wealth.
Kind of still
now you'll
today.
Find that in the report of 1916 published by Congress.
Nothing has changed.
In other words, Woodrow Wilson's administration in 1916 said, too few have too much. Too many have too little. They gave a table. They said that 2% of the people own 60% of the wealth. They said there's a middle class of 33% that owns 35% of the wealth. They said that 65% of the people own less than 5% of the wealth. That 2 million people own more than 110 million people. That was the finding of our industrial conference serving under the appointment of Congress and Woodrow Wilson, the president. And it says, I propose a limitation on the size of fortune, both ways. I propose a limitation on how big a fortune can get and a limitation on how little a fortune can get. I propose that a third the average is the smallest. One-third the average is the smallest. I propose that none should be over a few millions of dollars. A capital levy tax to be levied. The first 1 million not to be taxed except as it is now taxed. The second million to be taxed 1%. The third million 2%. the 4th million 4%, the 5th million 8%, the 6th million 16%, the 7th million 32%, the 8th million 64%, the 9th million 100%. To me, that no man with that tax levied against him every year can possess a fortune of more than from $3 to $4 or $5 million to any one man. Now what's that going to mean? That's going to mean that within 2 or 3 years' time, the United States finds the treasury of the United States in possession of $165 billion of the wealth of this country. $165 billion at the minimum. Then, we start from the bottom that the 25 or more million American families shall have a homestead. Louisiana has a homestead. Florida has a homestead. Texas has a homestead. That every citizen in the United States shall have a homestead up to $5,000. One-third the average wealth per family. Not like Mr. Brisbane said, when a man has to misstate the facts, he's probably run out of argument. My friend Arthur Brisbane, don't state the facts any longer. He argued with me a while, but he couldn't meet the facts. Now he has to misstate the facts, just 20 to 1 for the truth. In other words, 19/20 of what Mr. Brisbane says is a lie, and 1/20 is the truth. That's all. We're not going to destroy the Gulf Refining Company. We're not going to destroy the Standard Oil Company. But we're going to say that the limit of any one man's stock ownership in the Standard Oil Company is from $3 to $5 million to that individual, and that the balance of the people of America own the balance of what the Standard Oil Company is worth. All right. Then what are we going to do? We're going to guarantee, if our plan succeeds, and it is, don't fool yourself, it's going to win this country. It's going to win this country, not 1940. It won in 1932, but we didn't get it, but we're going to win again. 36. We're going to say then that every family in this country is entitled to the Florida and the Texas and the Louisiana homestead right, up to $5,000 or one-third the average. A home and the comforts of a home, including an automobile and a radio, the things it takes in that house to live on. 16. Now, if you have planted upon that table the food and the clothing and the products that it takes for 125 million people to live on, any man with a simple, full of sense ought to know that if you take 85% off of that table and give it to one man, that you're bound to have to search the people starving because they haven't got enough to eat. How many men ever went to a barbecue and would let one man take off the table what's intended for 9/10 of the people to eat? The only way you'll ever be able to feed the balance of the people is to make that man come back and bring back some of that grub. He ain't got no business. Now we've got a barbecue. We have been praying to the Almighty to send us to a feast. We have knelt on our knees morning and night time. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We have asked the Almighty to fulfill that prayer of the Scripture. the field. Give us rain in due season, and cause our fields to yield the abundance necessary for life. And that prayer has been answered. There has been yielded too much to eat, too much to wear, everything to live in. The Lord has answered the prayer. He has called the barbecue. Come to my feast. He fed the 125 million American people. But Paul and Rockefeller and Bella and Baruch have walked up and took 85% of the vittles off the table. Now, how are you going to feed the balance of the people? What's Morgan and Baruch and Rockefeller and Mellon going to do with all that trust? They can't eat it. They can't wear the clothes. They can't live in the house. Give them a yacht. Give them a parrot. Send them to Reno and give them a new wife. That's what they want. But when they've got everything on the God's living earth that they can eat, they can wear, they can live in, all that their children can live in and wear and eat, and all their children's children can use, then we got to call Mr. Morgan and Mr. Mellon and Mr. Rockefeller back to come back here. Well, that stuff back on this table here that you took away from them. You don't need. Leave something else for the American people to consume. And that's the problem. Now, my friends, I have been a rather belabored effort. Told you about everything I stand for, about everything I advocate in Congress. I can't anticipate all your questions. I won't undertake to do so. I would have loved in my early days to have had the opposite. They don't quit depending on a newspaper. They don't know where they're coming or going. They don't know what to say. One day they say one thing, another day they say another. But you have the nucleus, the composite group of people here, have the touch of the majority of the people of the United States. I'd like to have you, not supporting me. Maybe I can get along without it somehow or another. I'd like to have you study seriously, assiduously, whether or not the American country is going to survive without recalling to being what the Lord said had to be done. Whether or not an inequality, starvation among plenty, a nakedness in the land of too much, a homelessness amidst palaces, a luxury on the one hand, a pestilence on the other, whether or not we ought not to forget these big principles, and let the people of America understand that whether you've got an NRA, or a JRA, or a PWA, or a GIN, or a JUGR, what? That nothing can survive, that nothing can advance against this abundance, against this plenty, against this purpose, except that we say to America, 125 million, none shall be too big, none shall be too poor, none shall work too much, none shall be idle. No luxurious mansion center, none walking the streets, none impulse. None in pest, none in want, but in the land blessed by the smile of the Creator, with everything to be consumed, to be eaten, to be worn, that America will become a land sharing the fruits of the land, not for the favored few, not to satisfy greed, but that all may live in the land in which the Lord has provided abundance sufficient for the luxury and convenience of the people in Jackson. I think.
Huey Long. Huey Long. Speaking as only Huey Long could speak. Just wanted to bring out as a historical context of what the Democrats accused of. Huey wanted to pass out the wealth to everybody on some sort of an equal basis there, and I wanted to play that for you in all fairness. Now, I've talked about the propagandists on the right wing, and I don't think there's ever been more propaganda pushed forward than there is right now. And I think some of the propagandists we have today in the Republican Party have learned that they can say, in fact, anything they want to, and have a large portion of their followers believe anything that they say. There are many people walk around believing every word that Limbaugh, Hannity, Savage, all of them, they believe every word, Glenn Beck, that they say. And I don't think anybody ever proved that more or set the stage for that any more than Joseph McCarthy. And back when his famous red baiting and commie hunting was going on, he and Edward R. Murrow had quite the back and forth, and Edward R. Murrow had the best of it. But we'll start off with Joseph McCarthy in his speech in answer to Edward R. Murrow.
So tonight, we presented a report on Senator Joseph R. McCarthy. We labeled it as controversial. Most of that report consisted of words and pictures of the senator. At that time, we said, if the senator believes we have done violence to his words or pictures, if he desires to speak, to answer himself, an opportunity will be afforded him on this program. The senator sought the opportunity, asked for a delay of 3 weeks because, he said, he was very busy and he wished adequate time to prepare his reply. We agreed. We supplied the senator with a kinescope of that program of March 9 and with such scripts and recordings as he requested. We placed no restrictions upon the manner or method of the presentation of his reply, and we suggested take time to comment on this particular program. The senator chose to make his reply on film. Here now is Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, junior senator from Wisconsin.
Good evening. Mr. Edward R. Murrow, educational director of the Columbia Broadcasting System, devoted his program to an attack on the work of the United States Senate Investigating Committee and on me personally as its chairman. Now, over the past 4 years, he has made repeated attacks upon me and those fighting communists. And, of course, neither Joe McCarthy nor Edward R. Murrow is of any great as individuals. We are important in our relation to the great struggle to preserve our American liberty. The Senate Investigating Committee has forced out of government and out of important defense plans communists engaged in the Soviet conspiracy. And you know, it's interesting to note that the viciousness of Murrow's attacks is in direct ratio to our success in digging out communists. Now, ordinarily I would not take time out for the important work at hand to answer Murrow. However, in this case, I feel justified in doing so because Murrow is the symbol, the leader, and the cleverest of the jackal pack, which is always found at the throat of anyone who dares to expose individual communists and traitors. And I am compelled by the fact to say to you that Mr. Edward R. Murrow, as far back as 20 years ago, was engaged in propaganda for communist causes. For example, the Institute of International Education, of which he was the acting director, was chosen to act as a representative by a Soviet agency to do a job which would normally be done by the Russian secret police. Mr. Murrow sponsored a communist school in Moscow. In the selection of American students and teachers who were to attend, Mr. Murrow's organization acted for the Russian espionage and propaganda organization, known as Vox, V-O-K-S. And many of those selected were later exposed as communists. Murrow's organization selected such notorious communists as Isidore Begun, David Zabludowsky, and Senator Zabludowsky was forced out of the United Nations from my chief counsel, presented his case to the grand jury, and gave a picture of his communist activities. Now, Mr. Murrow, by his own admission, was a member of the IWW, that's the Industrial Workers of the World, a terrorist organization cited as subversive by an attorney general of the United States, who stated that it was an organization which seeks, and I quote, to alter the government of the United States by unconstitutional means. Now, other government committees have had before them actors, screenwriters, motion picture producers, and others who admitted communist affiliations, but pleaded youth or ignorance. Now, Mr. Murrow can hardly make the same plea. On March 9 of this year, Mr. Murrow, a trained reporter who had traveled all over the world, who was the educational director of CBS, followed implicitly the communist line as laid down in the last 6 months, laid down not only by the communist Daily Worker, but by the communist magazine Political Affairs and by the National Conference of the Communist Party of the United States of America. Now, the question, why is it important to you, the people of America, to know why the educational director and the vice president of CBS so closely follows the Communist Party line? To answer that question, we must turn back the pages of history. A little over 100 years ago, a little group of men in Europe conspired to deliver the world to a new system, to communism. Under their system, the individual was nothing, the family was nothing, God did not even exist. Their theory was that an all-powerful state should have the power of life or death over its citizens without even a trial, that everything and everybody belonged to the rulers of the state. They openly wrote, nothing secret about it, that in their efforts to gain power, they would be justified in doing anything. It would be justified in following the trail of deceit, lies, terror, murder, treason, blackmail. All these things were elevated virtues in the communist rule book. If a convert to communism could be persuaded that he was a citizen of the world, it, of course, would be much easier to make him a traitor to his own country. Now, for 70 years, the communists made little progress. Let me show you a map of the world as it stood in the middle of the First World War in 1917 before the Russian Revolution. You will see there was not a single foot of ground on the face of the globe under the domination or control of the communists. And bear in mind that this was only 36 years ago. In 1917, we were engaged in a great world war in defense of our way of life and in defense of American liberty. The Kaiser was obliged to divide his armies and fight on both the Eastern and the Western fronts. In the midst of the war, the Russian people overthrew their czarist master, and they set up a democratic form of government under the leadership of Alexander Kerensky. Now, Kerensky's government instantly pledged all-out support to the Allies. At this instant, the Imperial German government secretly financed the return to Russia of seven communist exiles led by Nikolai Lenin, exiles who had been forced to flee the country. A rather important event in the history of the world. Now, once in Russia, by the same methods which the communists are employing in the United States today, they undermine the army, they undermine the navy, the civilian heads of the government. And in 100 days, those seven communists were literally the masters of Russia. Now, with all of the wealth of the nation at their command, they proceeded to finance communist parties in every country of the world. They sent to those countries trained propagandists and spies. In every country, they, of course, had to find glib, clever men like Edward R. Murrow, who would sponsor invitations to students and teachers to attend indoctrination schools in Moscow, exactly as Murrow has done. They trained communists in every country in the world. Their sole purpose was to infiltrate the government, and once communists were in government, they in turn brought others in. Now let us look at the map of the world as it was 20 years ago. At that time, there was one country with 180 million people in communist chains. Now let us look at a map of the world as of tonight, this 6th day of April 1954. Over one-third of the Earth's area under communist control, and 800 million people in communist chains. In addition to the 800 million in communist chains in Europe and Asia, finally, the communists have gained a foothold and a potential military base here in our half of the world, in Guatemala, with the communists seeping down into the Honduras. My good friends, how much of this was achieved by military force, and how much was achieved by traitors and communist lying propagandists in our own government and in other free governments? Let's start in Europe, if we may. They took by military force a little piece of Finland. In the same way, they took three small Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia. They took half of Poland in the same way. They acquired the rest of Poland through Polish traitors and communists in our own government who gave American dollars and American support to the communists in Poland. They took over Romania, Bulgaria, and Hungary without firing a single shot. They did this by the infiltration of communists in the key spots in the governments. The communists took over Czechoslovakia without firing a shot. This they did by the infiltration of communists into the Czechoslovakian government also. And listen to what a high official in the anti-communist government of Czechoslovakia had to say about the communist enslavement of Czechoslovakia. Here's what he said. He said, in my country, the pattern was identical to what it is in the United States. If anyone, before the communists took over, dared to attack those communists who were preparing and shaping the policy of my government, shaping the policy to betray my people, he was promptly attacked and destroyed by a combination of communists, fellow travelers, and those unthinking people who thought they were serving the cause of liberalism and progress, but who were actually serving the cause of the most reactionary credo of all times, communism. Still quoting. Because of those people, night has fallen upon my nation and slavery upon my people. Now shifting to another area of the world, the East, how about this vast land area and the teeming masses of China? Let's just take a look at that map, if you please. Keep in mind that a few short years ago, China was a free nation friendly to the United States. Now, let's take a look at that map. Were those 400 million Chinese captured by force of arms? Certainly not. They were delivered to communist slave masters by the jackal pack of communist lying propagandists, including the friends of Mr. Edward R. Murrow, who day after day shouted to the world, the Chinese communists were agrarian reformers, and that our ally, the Republic of China, represented everything that was evil and wicked. Now, my good friends, if there were no communists in our government, would we have consented to and connived to turn over all of our Chinese friends to the Russians? Now, my good friends, if there had been no communists in our government, would we have rewarded them with all of Manchuria, half of the Kuril Islands, and one half of Korea? Now, how many Americans have died and will die because of this sellout to communist Russia? God only knows. If there were no communists in our government, why did we delay for 18 months, delay our research on the hydrogen bomb,
even though our intelligence agencies were reporting day after day that the Russians were feverishly pushing their development of the H-bomb. And may I say to America tonight that our nation may well die. Our nation may well die because of that 18 months deliberate delay. And I ask you, who caused it? Was it loyal Americans or was it traitors in our government? It is often said by the left wing that it is sufficient to fight communism in Europe and Asia, but that communism is not a domestic American issue. But the record, my good friends, is that the damage has been done by cleverly calculated subversion at home and not from abroad. It is this problem of subversion that our committee faces. Now, let us very quickly glance at some of the work of our committee. Some of the work is done in slightly over a year's time. For example, 238 witnesses were examined in public session, 367 witnesses examined in executive session, 84 witnesses refused to testify as to communist activities on the ground that if they told the truth, they might go to jail. 24 witnesses with communist backgrounds have been discharged from jobs which they were handling secret, top secret, confidential material. Individuals were exposed before our committee. Of course, you can't measure the success of a committee by a box score based on the number of communist heads that have rolled from secret jobs. It is completely impossible to even estimate the effect on our government of the day-to-day plotting exposure of communists. And that is, of course, why the Murrows bleed. For example, the exposure of only one Fifth Amendment communist in the government printing office, an office having access to secret material from almost every government agency, resulted in an undisclosed number of suspensions. It resulted in the removal of the loyalty board and the revamping of all the loyalty rules so that we do have apparently a good tight loyalty set up in the printing office this time. Also, a disclosure of communists in the military. And the radar laboratories resulted in the abolition of the Pentagon board, which had cleared and ordered reinstated communists who had for years been handling government secrets. Also, as a result of those hearings, Army orders have been issued to prevent the recurrence of the major press scandal, which was exposed by the committee. Now, to attempt to evaluate the effect of the work of an investigating committee would be about as impossible as to attempt to evaluate the effect of well-trained watchdogs upon the activities of potential burglars. We Americans live in a free world, a world where we can stand as individuals, where we can go to the church of our own choice and worship God as we please, each in his own fashion, where we can freely speak our opinions on any subject or on any man. Now, whether we shall continue to so live has come to issue now. We will soon know whether we are going to go on living that kind of life or whether we are going to live the kind of life that 800 million slaves live under communist domination. The issue is simple. It is the issue of life or death for our civilization. Now, Mr. Murrow said on this program, and I quote, he said, the actions of the junior senator from Wisconsin have given considerable comfort to the enemy. That is the language of our statute of treason, rather strong language. If I am giving comfort to our enemies, I ought not to be in the Senate. If, on the other hand, Mr. Murrow is giving comfort to our enemies, he ought not to be brought into the homes of millions of Americans by the Columbia Broadcasting System. Now, this is a question which can be resolved with very little difficulty. What do the communists think of me, and what do the communists think of Mr. Murrow? One of us is on the side of the communists. The other is against the communists. Against communist life. Now, the communists have three official publications in America. And these are not ordinary publications. They have been officially determined to be the transmission belts through which communists in America are instructed as to the party line or the position which communist writers and playwrights must take. Also, of course, telecasters, broadcasters. The first of these is a booklet which I would like to show you, if I may. It's entitled, The Main Report Delivered at the National Conference of the Communist Party of the USA, published in New York in October 1953. The report states, quote, the struggle against McCarthyism is developing currently along the following main line. Keep in mind, this is the communist publication giving instructions to the members of the party. On the following main line. Struggle against witch hunting, struggle against investigations of the McCarthy-McCarran type, and defense of the victims of McCarthyism, such as the one Lattimore, etc. In addition, there is the direct attack on McCarthy. May I ask you, does that sound somewhat like the program of Edward R. Murrow on March 9 over this same station? Now, in this report, the communists do not hesitate to instruct the comrades that their fight on McCarthy is only a means to a larger end. Again, let me quote from the instructions from the Communist Party to its membership on page 33. I quote, our main task is to mobilize the masses for the defeat of the foreign and domestic policy of the Eisenhower administration. And for the defeat of the Eisenhower regime itself. The struggle against McCarthyism contributes to this general objective. There's one more quotation, if I may, from page 31 of these instructions from the Communist Party to its members. I quote, since the elections, McCarthyism has emerged as a menace of major proportion. I think maybe we know what the Communist Party means by a menace of major proportions. I mean a menace of major proportions to the Communist Party. Now, let's take a 30 seconds or so, if we may, look a little further to see who's giving comfort to our enemies. Here is a Communist Daily Worker of March 9, containing 7 articles and a principal editorial, all attacking McCarthy, and the same issue lists Mr. Murrow's program as, listen to this, one of tonight's best bets on TV. And then just one more, here's the issue of March 17. His principal front page article is an attack on McCarthy. It has 3 other articles. Attacking McCarthy is a special article by William Z. Foster, the head of the Communist Party in America, and now under indictment on charges of attempting to overthrow this government by force and violence. This article by Foster, praising Edward R. Murrow. Just one more, if I may impose on your time. Issue of March 26. This issue has 2 articles attacking witch hunting, 3 articles attacking McCarthy, a cartoon of McCarthy, and an article in praise of Mr. Edward R. Murrow. And now I would like to also show you the Communist Political Organ, entitled Political Affairs. The lead article is a report dated November 21, 1953, of the National Committee of the Communist Party of the United States, attacking McCarthy and telling how the loyal members of the Communist Party can serve their cause by getting rid of this awful McCarthy. Now, as you know, Owen Lattimore has been named as a articulate instrument of communist conspiracy. He's been so named by the Senate Internal Security Committee. He is now under criminal indictment for perjury with respect to testimony in regard to his communist activities. In his book, Ordeal by Slander, he says, and I think I can quote him verbatim, he says, "I owe a very special debt to men I have never met. I must mention at least Edward R. Murrow." Then there's the book by Harold Lasky, admittedly the greatest communist propagandist of our time in England. In his book, Reflections on the Revolution of Our Times, he dedicates the book to my friends E.R. Murrow and Lanham Titchener with affection. I am perfectly willing to let the American people decide who is giving comfort to our enemies. Much of the documentation which we have here on the table tonight will not be available to the American people by way of television. However, this will all be made available to you within the next 2 weeks. In conclusion, may I say that under the shadow of the most horrible and destructive weapons that man has ever devised, we fight to save our country, our homes, our churches, our children. For this cause, ladies and gentlemen, I have dedicated and will continue to dedicate all that I have and all that I am. And I want to assure you that I will not be deterred by the attacks of the Murrows, the Lattimores, the Fosters, the Daily Worker, or the Communist Party itself. Now, I make no claim to leadership. In complete humility, I do ask you and every American who loves this country to join with me.
Film of Senator Joseph R. McCarthy, presented at our invitation. It was in response to a program we presented on March 9th. This reporter undertook to make no comment at this time, but naturally reserved his right to do so subsequently. Good night and good luck.
Last week, Senator McCarthy appeared on this program to correct any errors he might have thought we made in our report of March 9th. Since he made no reference to any statements of fact that we made, we must conclude that he found no errors of fact. He proved again that anyone who exposes him, anyone who does not share his hysterical disregard for decency and human dignity and the rights guaranteed by the Constitution, must be either a communist or a fellow traveler. I fully expected this treatment. The senator added this reporter's name to a long list of individuals and institutions he has accused of serving the communist cause. His proposition is very simple. Anyone who criticizes or opposes McCarthy's methods must be a communist. And if that be true, there are an awful lot of communists in this country. For the record, let's consider briefly some of the senator's charges. He claimed, but offered no proof, that I had been a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. That is false. I was never a member of the IWW, never applied for membership. Men that I worked with in the Pacific Northwest in Western Washington and logging camps will attest that I never had any affiliation or affinity with that organization. The senator charged that Professor Harold Lasky, a British scholar and politician, dedicated a book to me. That's true. He is dead. He was a socialist. I am not. He was one of those civilized individuals who did not insist upon agreement with his political principles as a precondition for conversation or friendship. I did not agree with his political ideas. Lasky, as he makes clear in the introduction, dedicated the book to me not because of political agreement, but because he held my wartime broadcast from London in high regard. And the dedication so reads. Senator McCarthy's principal attack on me was an attack on the Institute of International Education, of which I was assistant director and am now a trustee, together with such people as John Foster Dulles, Milton Eisenhower, Ralph J. Bunce, Virginia Gildersleeve, Philip Reed, to name just a few. That institute sponsored, acted as the registering agent, for summer schools in foreign countries, including England, France, and Germany, and one in the Soviet Union in 1934. It has arranged in all some 30,000 exchanges of students and professors between the United States and over 50 foreign countries. The man primarily responsible for starting this institute was Nicholas Murray Butler in 1919. Its work has been praised as recently as 1948 by President Eisenhower. It has been denounced by the Soviet press and radio as a center of international propaganda for American reaction, and I have been labeled by them as a reactionary radio commentator. The senator alleged that we were doing the work of the Russian secret police, training spies. We were, in fact, conducting normal cultural and educational relations with foreign nations. The Moscow summer session was canceled in 1935 by the Russian authorities. I believed 20 years ago, and I believe today, that mature Americans can engage in conversation and controversy, the clash of ideas with communists anywhere in the world without becoming contaminated or converted. I believe that our faith, our conviction, our determination are stronger than theirs, and that we can compete and successfully, not only in the area of bombs, but in the area of ideas. Senator McCarthy couldn't even get my present relationship with CBS straight. He repeatedly referred to me as the educational director, a position I have not held for 17 years. The senator waved a copy of the Daily Worker, saying an article in it has praised me. Here is an example of what Senator McCarthy calls praise by William Z. Foster in the March 17 issue of the Daily Worker. Quote, "During the past 10 days, Senator McCarthy has received a number of resounding belts in the jaw. These came from Adlai Stevenson, E.R. Murrow, Senator Flanders, the Army leadership, broadcasting companies. Even Eisenhower himself had to give McCarthy a slap on the wrist." That was the sole reference to me in Mr. Foster's article. Another charge by Senator McCarthy was that Owen Lattimore mentioned me in a book. What Lattimore said in substance was that he had never met me, but that I had done a fair job of reporting his testimony. In short, that I had not presumed his guilt. Everything I said on that case is a matter of record and can be examined by anyone who is interested. I hope to continue to present evidence developed before congressional committees as impartially as I am able. And that specifically includes the hearings before which Senator McCarthy is shortly scheduled to appear. I have worked for CBS for more than 19 years. The company has subscribed fully to my integrity and responsibility as a broadcaster and as a loyal American. I require no lectures from the junior senator from Wisconsin as to the dangers or terrors of communism. Having watched the aggressive forces at work in Western Europe, having had friends in Eastern Europe butchered and driven into exile, having broadcast from London in 1943, that the Russians were responsible for the Katyn massacre, having told the story of the Russian refusal to allow Allied aircraft to land on Russian fields after dropping supplies to those who rose in Warsaw and then were betrayed by the Russians, and having been denounced by the Russian radio for these reports, I cannot feel that I require instruction from the senator on the evils of communism. Having searched my conscience and my files, I cannot contend that I have always been right or wise, but I have attempted to pursue the truth with some diligence and to report it, even though, as in this case, I had been warned in advance that I would be subjected to the attentions of Senator McCarthy. We shall hope to deal with matters of more vital interest to the country next week. Good night and good luck.
Edward R. Murrow, stating the case as only Edward R. Murrow could do so. The reason we played this today was to point out what is happening today. We have great propagandists on the radio today. Your Glenn Beck, your O'Reilly, your Mark Levin and Hannity and Limbaugh, and Mike Gallagher and Neil Bortz, and the list goes on and on. And they basically go unchallenged for the most part and say anything they like on the radio. Anything they like. And it goes basically unchallenged. And why does it go unchallenged? Mostly because there is no wherewithal from the left to put forth, to sponsor radio programs. Oh, yes, we've got token TV programs, very little on the radio, to answer these people. Thank God in the days of McCarthy that CBS, that Edward R. Murrow had the power of CBS behind him and the money to answer Joseph McCarthy and make him look like a fool and be instrumental in the downfall of Joseph McCarthy. And no, we do not have any Edward R. Murrows today on the left, basically, because we don't have a presence. And the reason we don't have the presence, a lot of that, is that we don't have the backing that the people on the right do. Why? I'll never know. I'm basically tired of the argument that the Republicans have more money. I think we showed in the recent election that we could certainly raise more money than the Republicans did. But there has never been a successful, meaningful effort on the left to counter the lies and mass destruction taking place by the talkers on the right. Somebody explain it to me. Somebody explain it to me why the community on the left, the liberal progressive community, will not back enough people to fight this propaganda that we hear every day. You know, millions of people listen to those right-wingers every single day and walk away believing their arguments. And many of them walk away believing their arguments because they don't have an alternative put forth. I know where I live now, you can't get anything over the air. Can't get anything from the left. And in many places across the country, you cannot. And this bothers me, it worries me, it frightens me that these people, for the most part, go unchallenged. And as I said, oh yes, we've got a couple of TV programs, but basically on the radio, we have very, very little. Somebody tell me why. Why, oh why, the left doesn't support the anti-propaganda message that many of us like to put out. The things we say to counter the right-wing talkers, we're but a little megaphone in a huge stadium of people. I don't know why it is, and I've never had it adequately explained to me. But that's the reason we played that today. I wanted you to hear it. I wanted you to hear what the master propaganda sounded like and what it sounded like to have it shoved in his face by somebody with a reputation and a lot of money and a network behind. I don't know. I don't know why it is. Anyway, I do want to thank all of you for listening to the program today. I found the Edward R. Murrow and McCarthy back and forth to be interesting, and I hope you did as well. Thanks for listening. You're listening to the Guy James Show here on the Head On Radio Network, and we will be back tomorrow. Hope to see you then.